Welcome back to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Russo. We head out now on the waters of the Chesapeake Bay, where Maryland and Virginia crabbers have by and large been having a pretty successful season. Watermen have a variety of theories as to why the bay's once dwindling crab population seems to be making a comeback. But one thing they can't all agree on is that they're still very worried about the long-term future of their industry. In just a few minutes, we'll talk with some of those crabbers about the new team they've created to work with Maryland's Department of Natural Resources and come up with solutions to the challenges facing local watermen. But first, Coastal Connection's Tara Boyle goes out on the water with a man who's been pulling up crab pots for more than four decades.
Bob Evans has a beef with Mother Nature. Captain Bob, as he likes to be called, is a waterman who spends his days catching crabs on the Chesapeake Bay. But all the rain we've gotten in the past few weeks is messing with his business.
I know fellas yesterday that lost $30,000 worth of crab pots.
The rainwater flows into the bay from local rivers, bringing all sorts of debris with it, in a process Captain Bob refers to as a freshet. It's bad for certain marine species, oysters in particular, and bad for crab pots.
So we have to take our pots and put extra weights and buoys on them, so when this freshet of water hits us, it doesn't take our stuff away, too.
That means Captain Bob and his crew, watermen Kyle Snyder and Sergio Leyva, have a long day ahead of them. They're out at Captain Bob's boat in Shadyside, Maryland by 7:30 in the morning on a recent Friday. The skies threaten to bring even more rain as they load crab pots, bushel barrels, and about a dozen rust-colored weights onto the boat. The captain fires up the engine, and it's time to begin another day on the water. He's been at this 6 days a week for more than 40 years in all kinds of weather and water conditions.
Well, I had a progression. I started out in a skip, you know, 16-foot boat.
Which led to a 22-foot boat.
And then I got a 32-foot boat, and then I bought this boat.
It's sort of a war horse built for one purpose, to catch a lot of crabs. And you could probably say the same thing about Captain Bob himself, the son of a pharmacist and a teacher who fell in love with the water.
What do we got?
We got 2 dozen jumbos.
As we head out on the bay, he has to shout over the roar of the engines as he shares his family's story.
My grandmother was 108 when she passed away. Until the day she died, she always, every time I saw her, she would say, "Have you got a real job yet, or are you still playing around on the water?"
But it becomes clear pretty quickly that this playing around on the water is actually grueling work. The team spends several hours putting weights on empty pots in preparation for the rainwater that's coming with the freshet. And once that's done, it's time to finally begin catching some crabs. The boat idles next to one of Captain Bob's buoys, and the team uses a pulley system to haul the first metal crab pot out of the depths. It's covered in marine plants and gelatinous sea nettles, and it's Sergio's job to haul the pot onto the boat and dump the crabs into a metal bin known as a cull box. The crabs are brownish-gray with those telltale blue claws, and they skitter around frantically as Kyle sorts them according to their size.
Nothing to it. We just come out here and dump the gold out every day.
But there isn't as much gold in the bay as there used to be. Captain Bob says he grosses about $800 a day.
If I gross $800 a day, I make $200.
Not enough to get rich, but enough to pay the bills and put his daughters through college. Still, he's worried this way of life may be disappearing. The evidence of it, he says, can be seen in his own community of Shadyside.
If you look around here now, it's a half a dozen watermen. There used to be 400 workboats tied up here.
And he's particularly concerned about the future of younger watermen, such as Kyle and Sergio. These men will have lots to worry about, from hurricanes to pollution to political battles over the bay.
Well, I think it's the beginning of the end, really, unless there's some things change. Certain things will do well, but, you know, we have no clams, no oysters. The striped bass fishery is at a point where it's regulated down to a part-time fishery. It's nothing for people to do on the water.
Nothing, that is, except continue the hunt for the bay's most iconic species, the Maryland blue crab, and hope it will continue to provide a living for the next generation of watermen.
That was Coastal Connection's Tara Boyle, out on the water last Friday with Bob Evans, who was one of several watermen I spoke with last week. They're all part of a group called the Blue Crab Design Team, which meets every month at the Holiday Inn Express in Graysonville, Maryland. In addition to Evans, I spoke with Bill Rice, a commercial crabber and fisherman, Larry Sims, the president of the Maryland Watermen's Association, Mick Blackstone, the editor of Maryland Watermen's Gazette, and Pete Jensen, the former deputy secretary of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. We started by talking about how the state regulates the crabbing industry. Here's Bob Evans again.
When I started out in this business, I was basically a striped bass fisherman, a rock fisherman. Well, they've regulated us completely out of the rockfish business. It's a part-time fishery. I don't want it to happen to the crab fishery. A lot of the regulations that they have is overmanagement. A mandatory day off a week that you cannot change during the year. You know, if a man wants to take Sundays off in the fall, he should be able to switch his day. If a man wants to switch areas or switch gears, he shouldn't have to jump through all the hoops from regulations that don't amount to anything.
Talk about what, in a perfect world, what could be done on the short term to fix the day-to-day for you gentlemen.
On the short term, you know, you always have to keep the resource in mind and make sure that there's plenty of resource available to replenish the stocks. But on the other hand, the part of the resource that is available to be harvested should be harvested in a manner that presents the most economic gain for the harvesters. And I think that's something that I've always tried to promote, and I think this group is behind it, that it's not how much you catch, it's how much money you make, because that's the bottom line. That's what keeps you in business, and that's why we crab, to make a living.
And, you know, certainly in addition to all the regulations, there's also these, you know, there's imports coming in from other countries of the very items that you guys are catching and then selling and making a living off of. So also, you know, the imports from other countries as well as places domestically that are, you know, selling crab meat and fish. What is that doing, the import business, what is that doing to you gentlemen in your livelihood?
Well, I think you've hit on an important point, because the U.S. is now importing 80% of the seafood we consume. 50% of it is by aquaculture from other countries. And I think, you know, I don't know what the direct impact is on the watermen themselves, but it's having a direct impact on a very big business for the state of Maryland and for the whole nation. And so to the extent that we can foster our resources and our watermen can benefit from it, that's what I think we want to accomplish.
Mick, I want to turn to you for a second. You know, in your coverage with the Maryland Watermen's Gazette, are you finding that these gentlemen and the watermen here on the bay are being heard more now that they've kind of congregated together and created this design team? Or are they still kind of, you know, just barking at the moon, so to speak, trying to be heard by the politicians?
No, I think the politicians and the bureaucrats are starting to wake up to the fact that the design team intentions for the future of the fishery and the future of watermen, which are both supposed to be sustained through this effort, they're starting to wake up to that. We need to do more to educate them and to accept this as a priority and understand that this is the direction the industry and the fishery have to go. And I think they are. Our big issue right now, since we just kind of started this thing, you know, whatever, 6 months ago, is to get other watermen to buy in and to understand what we're doing. So every month in the paper, and we have a lot of people calling, we give a summary of what this meeting did, what next month's meeting will do, and so forth. And we also have members of the design team spreading the gospel about it as well. And I hope that this is going to be one of the things that expands the membership and the unity of the industry, that is a catalyst for that.
And, you know, what is the status of, you know, it seems that the watermen are very close-knit community, kind of a fraternity of sorts. If there's only, you know, there's fewer and fewer of you. But then, of course, last year, one of the largest story to come out of the watermen community, unfortunately, was this poaching scandal with the rockfish. I guess talk about the dynamics between the gentlemen and the people and the families that are still out there on the water trying to make a living. Is it, you know, everybody's trying to band together to sustain a future? Or is it very, you know, cutthroat, tooth and nail, trying to just make their piece of the pie? Bob?
Well, the watermen themselves are a community of people that work together. 95% of us all work together and help each other out. When you talk about the poachers, you're talking about a very minute group of men that really the whole situation was caused by the Department of Natural Resources themselves for no enforcement. Anytime you take and you work on the water for years and you never get checked, people get sloppy. And those that aren't as honest as the other ones go overboard about it. And then all of a sudden, you end up with a bust like this, and it was all caused by no enforcement. When you go to work and you don't, it's just like anybody that drives down the road. You drive down the road and you never see a policeman. The first month you drive 10 miles over the limit. The second month you drive 20 miles over the limit. Well, 2 years later, you're driving 100 miles an hour every place you go. And that's what happened to those watermen, was sloppiness and no enforcement.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Coastal Connection on 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. I'm your host, Brian Russo. I'm talking with members of the Maryland Blue Crab Design Team. They're all working to come up with proposals to address the future of the local crabbing industry here on the shore. Gentlemen, we've been talking about the future. And, you know, one of the most interesting things in talking to some watermen is this notion that, you know, as I guess with the future comes the next generation of watermen. You know, Larry, I remember several months ago you were on the show and we were talking about it, and you said this is not an industry that the young guys want to get into because it's hard for everybody to survive, and they see that. Talk about your concerns moving forward about, you know, really cultivating and growing that next generation of watermen.
Yeah, well, that's another reason for this design team. We worry about not having young watermen getting into business. And let's say 10 years from now, if we make a part-time fishery out of it, which is leaning towards now, the young people won't have a chance. Where if we can make it so somebody can make a good, decent living out of it, then the young people have a chance. We want to make sure we have an avenue for them to get in and get a license and be able to do that. And it's pretty simple. If you make a business profitable, you have young people get in it. If you got a business right now where everybody's just hanging on by a shoestring, then the young people are not going to get in it because it costs too much to get in it, and they don't see a way to recoup their money. So we think but if we do the right things, it'll be a way for them to get in it because there'll be a way to see that they can pay for it.
I just want to kind of go around the circle here. And tell me how long you guys have been out there on the water making a living at this. And we'll just start there and go from there.
40 years.
60 years.
40 years.
Well, I haven't been on the water, but I've been in natural resources management for 50 years. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's almost 200 years of experience sitting just in the semicircle. So under these conditions that we've all been talking about here, the regulation, you know, the market, you know, pinch and people, you know, saturating the market with imports and other things from domestic areas throughout the United States, is this, I guess, the most difficult the industry's been in memory?
Yes, most definitely, because just as Larry alluded to, it's evolved into a part-time fishery. When I got out of high school, my first step was to get my boat ready to go hand tong in Eastern Bay. We hand tong from the 15th of September till the 1st of January, made good money. Then we fish for rockfish until May, and then we fish for crabs from May till September. And what has happened now is we're trying to save the crab fishery because that's the best fishery we've got going for us. But not only do we need to save the crab fishery, to give somebody an opportunity to be a full-time waterman, we have to have a better striped bass fishery. We have to have a better oyster fishery. We have to develop markets for species that weren't even in existence, like the blue catfish and those types of things, where somebody can actually make a living. So some of the part-timeness is due to the fact that we're forced into being part-timers. I have some real good young watermen in my area that have to have on-land jobs that are still crabbing because they can't make a living 6 or 7 months out of the year.
In the big picture, the other thing that watermen and we worry about is the fact that we need to have the public support us and what we do and help us in the legislature and so forth, because we do have adversaries that would like watermen to go away because they want all the fish. So, and a big part of that in today's world is the fact that elections cost so much money, and these organizations have the wherewithal to dump a lot of money into political campaigns. Once they do that, an elected official has an obligation to them, not to us. So it takes real strong political will for any elected official, and Senator Mikulski is one, who is dedicated to this industry and to these men and women. But it is a real challenge for us to gain supporters. It's an interesting, it's an ironic situation that if you have a Waterman's Festival, thousands of people come out to meet the watermen, see the docking contest, eat the crabs, do all this and do that. We need to convert them into really supporting the industry.
Because, you know, certainly part of the history and the rich history of the Eastern Shore involves what you gentlemen do on the water. And you know, I've talked to some farmers that spoke about what you were mentioning, is that they're not able to sustain their families on just farming anymore. They're actually turning into moonlight farmers, and they're getting day jobs, and they're farming on the weekends. You know, with just from a historical standpoint about this region, do you guys feel like at all that it's in jeopardy of becoming nostalgia rather than a part of the everyday?
I'll give you some history on what you just touched on. When I graduated from high school, I grew up on a tobacco farm in southern Maryland. I absolutely hated it. I couldn't stand tobacco. I waited all year to get one paycheck, so I couldn't wait to get out of school so I could be a full-time waterman. And that lasted until, when was the Rockfish moratorium, Larry?
85.
Okay, so 85. So from 1972 to 1985, I was 100% full-time waterman. I caught crabs, oysters, fish, and eels, and muskrats, or anything else I could find a market for that was legal. All right, when the Rockfish moratorium came along, I had to basically eat some crow, and I went back and had to start raising a little crop of tobacco again, and I found that I hated it as much as I did in the beginning. So then I started raising corn, wheat, and soybeans on a small-time basis. Well, now I'm moonlight farming and moonlight crabbing, or daylight farming and moonlight, whatever you want to say, I'm doing both. And the reason I'm doing it is because I have to do it. I can't make it farming, and I can't make it crabbing. And when you put both of them together, I'm the biggest gambler that ever went to Las Vegas.
Pete, from an environmental standpoint, there's much to be said about this balance between the fishery, and a lot of the political chatter is about that, this environmental talk. Talk about, I guess, some of the ways that things can be done to make it so the fishery is protected, but also the watermen are protected so they can make a living, they can pay their bills, they can sustain a life.
Yeah, well, I think that is one of the overall goals, to make sure that regulations do conserve the resource for everybody's benefit in the future. Your focus is the watermen, but I think there's more at stake here, and that is cracking crabs in Maryland is an iconic experience. And so the public has a huge stake in what's gone on here, and I hope that they're going to be able to see that the watermen have a purpose here that's going to serve everybody, not just themselves. And so environmentally, yes, there's a lot that needs to be done for the Chesapeake Bay and the blue crabs and all the other resources. You know, oysters have just about disappeared, and so there's a lot of work to be done.
That was Pete Jensen, the former Deputy Secretary of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. We also heard from Waterman Bill Rice and Bob Evans, Larry Sims, the president of the Maryland Watermen's Association, and Mick Blackstone, the editor of Maryland Watermen's Gazette.